Tweet at TodaySOR.
Last Tuesday marked International Women's Day, and as part of the celebrations, a number of events took place to commemorate the women of the 1916 Rising. But just how significant a role did women really play in the 1916 Rising? Why have many of them been airbrushed from history? And what was it like for the women of 1916 in the aftermath of the Rising? Well, joining me now in studio to discuss the role of women at that time is Diarmaid Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD. Diarmaid, you're very welcome here this morning. Thank you for coming in to us. I suppose we're all familiar with some of the bigger names of the Rising, people like Countess Markievicz. But how big a role overall did women really play? Were there many women involved in it?
There were many women involved. There were in the region of 250 to 300 women who played a role in 1916.
And how does that compare to the number of men?
Well, you're looking at overall about 1,600-1,700 rebels in Dublin in Easter week. So it's quite a significant component. And you wouldn't know that from looking at a lot of the older history books, because the story was very much structured around the idea of the men of 1916. I took down a souvenir booklet from the shelves there recently from 1966 for the 50th anniversary. And there were photographs of the pageant in Croke Park, and it was Shochter Fear, Shocht Law. So 7 men, 7 days. And the narrative was very much constructed around that. Yes, there was a nod in the direction of Constance Markievicz, who was a very significant player and a very important politician, as well as a fighter. But we didn't really have that sense of a much wider female participation. And again, you've got to go back to the environment and the various undercurrents in the run-up to 1916. I mean, why would women be coming into public life? Why would they be coming more visibility? There are a lot of women who are involved in the trade union movement, the Irish Women's Workers Union, for example, whose first secretary was Delia Larkin, the sister of James Larkin. That had about 5,000 members at the time of the 1916 Rising, and many of them were involved in the Irish Citizen Army. The Irish Citizen Army accepted women on equal terms to men, which the Irish Volunteers didn't.
Yeah, which you don't really hear about. But Diarmaid, I mean, to go back to the role that these, 250-odd women played in the 1916 Rising, were they in support roles? Were they, as we would often see, making the sandwiches or running around with messages? Or were they really in there thinking this through, coming up, commanding it?
They were both. Of course there were women in supportive roles, and you've got to appreciate the cultural environment of the time. There were many men who thought it simply was not appropriate for women to be in the firing line, and that they would be doing the carrying of dispatches, or they would be making tea and sandwiches, and they would be tending to the wounded, and they did do that. But you also have then the very direct participation of women in combat. And this is where we have a number of different names now coming into the public domain who perhaps weren't familiar in previous times. There was a book launched there for International Women's Day called We Were There, and it's about the 77 women who ended up in Richmond Barracks at the end of the Rising, having been arrested for their role. And if you consider a character like Margaret Skinner, for example, who comes over from Glasgow, she's a school teacher, she gets wind that the Rising is being planned through suffragette contacts. She comes over and she's very, very badly wounded in Harcourt Street. You have Bridget Lyons, who comes up from Longford and fights in the forecourts. You have Rose McNamara, who was the head of the female contingent in the Marrowbone Lane distillery. So, and even, you know, even the first shots that were fired in the Rising, if you look at the assault on Dublin Castle, again, you've got 9 women and 10 men. So they're the Citizen Army, again, very much there. So the answer is they were in both roles. What we have now, Caelan, is an enormous amount of personal testimony from women that has been released in recent years, and it gives us a much stronger sense of the texture of 1916, and that includes a very significant female involvement.
The woman you mentioned there, Margaret Skinner, who came over from Glasgow, is it accurate to say she was actually active as a sniper during the Rising?
Oh, it is. That was her role. It is, yes. And you see, women, particularly those who were involved in those organisations that are emerging in 1913, Irish Volunteers, Irish Citizen Army, they are training with rifles. Now, obviously, arms are relatively limited, but some of them become crackshot, and they are a serious threat to the British soldiers in 1916. So some of them would have been very proficient in rifle practice. If you look at the Constitution of Common Man, for example, the female auxiliary of the Irish Volunteers, it specifically states that they will train in rifle practice. And some of them take that very seriously. And of course, some of them were very emboldened by the 1916 proclamation, because it was addressed to Irish men and Irish women.
Very much so. It was a very progressive document, wasn't it, in terms of equality of genders?
It was, and it promises them the vote, which of course they didn't have at that time.
But I suppose it brings us to the big question. At what point did this airbrushing of women out of the history of the 1916 Rising begin? And why did it begin when, as you say, the proclamation itself was so much more inclusive?
It's remarkably revealing that when some of these female participants apply for military service pensions in the 1920s, the Department of Defence has a dilemma on its hands. Margaret Skinner, who I mentioned, for example, applied for a pension based on having been wounded in 1916 on her active service. And she is told by the Department of Defence that soldiers are defined by the pensions legislation as soldiers understood in the masculine sense. Officially, she didn't exist in 1916.
And she was actually told that.
She was told that. It's there in black and white. This is why this documentation that's coming to us from the Military Service Pension Archive is fascinating. And she has to fight a 13-year battle to get recognition. And women were initially excluded from the terms of the pension legislation. Cumann na mBan are then brought into it. But it gives you an idea of the kind of atmosphere that existed in the 1920s. It's also revealing that there was a bishop's pastoral in 1922, which essentially tells women to desist from revolutionary activity. And the idea is that women have had their fighting, they've had their fun. It's time now to get back into the home. And there is a power vacuum there during the Civil War and after. And certainly the church plays its role in filling that. And it has a very paternalistic view of women and what they should be doing. The ethos that develops in the 1920s and beyond is very much based on the idea of women being prescribed a particular role and a very limited role. And many of them do feel betrayed by that.
On that point, so from what you're saying there, things actually changed between 1916 and the mid-1920s. There was a change in the way women were perceived.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, even by the early 1920s, P.S. O'Hegarty, for example, who's a very visible and loud Sinn Féin activist from that era, is deliberately describing women as the Furies. These Republican women who won't accept the new state, these Republican women who are insisting that the promises of 1916 have to be delivered on and the proclamation promises have to be realised, and they're being dismissed as irrational, as trigger-happy harpies, as the Furies, as irrational creatures, essentially. You can see that from the early 1920s. And again, the idea is that there were exceptional circumstances during the 1916 Rising and the revolutionary period generally, but that now is over. And you have to draw a veil over that.
And is there any writing from the time of 1916? I mean, you talk about the Furies, the irrational women in the 20s. Is there writing that is opposite to that in 1916? Or was it just lip service being paid then as well? Or was there a real, if you like, welcoming of these women?
Depending on what organisation you were involved in or what your political preferences or prejudices were, I mean, we know notoriously that Eamon de Valera did not allow women into his battalion when he was in Boland's Mills. But he was the exception. And it's important to remember that women were accepted and were welcomed in the other areas. There were certain concerns about them being in the line of fire, but they're very much a part of it. And if you take characters like James Connolly and even Patrick Pearse, they are very much supportive of the idea of women's liberation, of women getting the vote. Yes, they may have had their own attitudes, in Pearse's case, to what exactly women should be doing, for example, in the GPO in 1916. But there is a very firm commitment amongst cultural and political activists, or certainly many of them, to the idea of full equality between the sexes. And again, if you go back to this idea of women's participation in the workforce and the cultural endeavours of women, and Helena Maloney, a trade unionist, an Abbey actress, and she had very strong views on politics. She later becomes the first female president of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. Or Margaret Skinner, who I mentioned, who goes on to become a female president of the Irish National Teachers Organisation. So they are steeped in that revolutionary tradition, but they bring it in then to a new era. And they are fighting often against the prevailing prejudicial currents. Mm. But they do manage to make themselves visible and make their voices heard. And if you look at the contemporary writings of 1916 and the testimony that we have, you can see that determination on the part of many women to be recognised in the public sphere, to be recognised as soldiers as well as politicians, as well as activists. But then you've got the issue of how women were portrayed subsequently. A lot of women were defined by their men. If you take the way the
defined as widows, grieving widows, rather than heroes of the rising.
Consider the way this was communicated, and it's not just through books. Think of a song. You will remember, Caelan, a song called Grace, which was sung by the great Jim McCann back in the 1980s. And it tells the story of the poignant and tragic last few hours of Joseph Mary Plunkett, one of the signatories of the proclamation, who's already dying because he's so ill, awaiting his execution. And he marries Grace Gifford on the eve of his execution. And Grace Gifford is from that marvellous family of Gifford sisters who were involved in so many aspects of the politics and the culture of that era. And Grace Gifford is the patient, suffering spouse. Oh, Grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. And there's a line in the song, "Now I know it's hard for you, my dear, to ever understand the love I bear for these brave men, my love for this dear land. But Porrick called me down to the GPO and I had to go." And if you consider that, "Now I know it's hard for you, my love, to ever understand." I mean, it's a beautiful song, but there's a patronising attitude there. And when Grace then goes looking for recognition of her service, because she was not a fighter, but she was a cartoonist, an illustrator for the Republican movement. And propaganda is a very important part of this. She doesn't qualify for a pension because her service is not recognised. But what she does qualify for is a widow's pension based on her having been married to one of the signatories of the proclamation.
So no recognition of her contribution.
So she's defined
only.
She's defined by her status as a widow of 1916, as opposed to being defined by what she did. And again, that was quite common. And yet there are others, of course, who are keepers of the flame, like Kathleen Clark, the widow of Tom Clark, who's not only a keeper of the flame, she's also a very vocal and very active politician, the first female Lord Mayor of Dublin, and she lives until 1972. And she's there in 1966 to tell her tale, and she had very strong views on what had happened. So it's very, very mixed. But it is fair to say that far too many of these women were defined by their relationship with the dead men. And again, it goes back to the idea of the men of 1916. But what we have now for the centenary of the 1916 Rising is a much greater appreciation of the role that women played.
And some of the information, if you like, that has been uncovered is really quite fascinating. I mean, the story of a 15-year-old who was locked into her bedroom by her mother because her mother wanted to keep her out of it.
Well, there's a story now. There's a story we didn't know before. And we have to pay tribute to the historians who've been uncovering these stories, Lucy McDermott and Mary McAuliffe and Liz Gillis and Sinead McCool. Lucy McDermott tells the story of Mary McLaughlin. She's a 15-year-old shop assistant in Arnott's. And she is moving around the city between Stephen's Green and Jacobs and the Royal College of Surgeons, and she's carrying guns and messages. Her brother arrives and he tells her in no uncertain terms to go home. She goes home. She's locked in her bedroom by her mother. She then escapes out the window and returns to the GPO. These are the kind of stories that we haven't heard before. And even if you consider the end of it and the surrender, Rose McNamara, who was leading that female contingent in Marrowbone Lane, those women were told to go home. They were not going to be arrested because they were women. But they march out with great dignity and determination and say, "We are on an equal footing with the men who are surrendering and we want to be treated the same." And that's when they're taken off to Richmond Barracks. So they are making a very definite point. They could have evaded arrest on grounds of their sex. They didn't.
They stood up to it. But it really is fascinating, Dermot, isn't it? I mean, all of this information is coming out now as part of the centenary. It has been covered. It has been lost. We're very lucky to be able to access this type of information 100 years after the event.
What we've had really is a revolution in the accessibility of archival material in the last 15 years in particular. And so much of it is available in digital form. There's a very strong emphasis now on the witness statements and on the pension applications because people had to account for what they had done or what they had not done. And we're beginning to see the variety of female voices, the variety of female perspectives. And we also get the mothers of civilians who had been killed, who are left bereft, heartbroken, and they have strong views on what has happened. And again, getting that sense of the female civilian experience in 1916. Of course, there were those women, many women, who were horrified by it. But there's also another category of women, the separation women, as they were known, who had husbands serving on the front. And even in Easter week 1916, there were nearly 600 men, Irish men, killed on the Western Front. So there, many of their wives are at home And they have a very strong hostility towards the 1916 Rising. And we have to recognise them as being a very distinct and very interesting category
yes,
of women.
Yes, and it is a voice that we have heard very little of. So basically, this information, it's been sitting around for 100 years at this point.
Well, a lot of it was locked up.
Accessing.
A lot of it was locked up for a long time. I mean, the statements of the Bureau of Military History were taken from veterans in the 1940s and the 1950s, but they weren't released until 2003. And it's a reminder that many did believe that to release this material too soon would generate tensions, would reopen old wounds. The great privilege that we have now, 100 years on, is to have access to that treasure trove of voices. And it's fantastic that so many of them are female voices, because we can really reimagine and reconceptualise the whole Rising. It does make the narrative of the Rising much more complicated, but it makes it a hell of a lot more interesting.
Absolutely. Well, Diarmaid Farida, thank you very much indeed for coming into us this morning. That's Diarmaid Farida there, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.